people in America and also in other nations being targeted by foreign intelligence services and other hostile actors.
So what has the U.S. government done? They've made a movie. It's Friday, October 2nd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, Hong Kong riot police patrol the route of a banned anti-government march preventing big crowds from gathering. We'll take a closer look at perhaps the most controversial political debate in U.S. history. It is all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. government claims that China and other foreign governments are using professional networking social media sites to target people with U.S. government security clearances. To make their point, two agencies, the FBI and the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, have released a new movie. I spoke with Dean Boyd, Chief Communications Executive at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. But first, here's a short segment of the movie.
About the document, my colleagues agreed. The information was perhaps too, how you say, vanilla? They're requesting more specific details regarding your experiences with the Navy's program.
Why a movie? Why have you guys decided to do this?
This is necessary because it's we're pointing out and illustrating a threat that we see not only targeting Americans but individuals around the globe in government, industry, and academia. We see people in America and also in other nations being targeted by foreign intelligence services and other hostile actors using fake profiles on social media platforms, including professional networking platforms. It's an issue that's growing, and unfortunately, it has been successful in multiple cases in which unsuspecting individuals who may post their resume or their credentials on a professional networking site are targeted by individuals overseas. Approached and asked to connect, and then slowly over time they are asked to provide additional information, and the relationship kind of develops from there. But specifically what we see is individuals in a company or in the intelligence community or what have you, who have access to information that a foreign intelligence services want. And it could be unclassified information. It could be trade secrets about a commercial jet aircraft or cutting-edge research being conducted at a university or, biomedical research. Or it could be more sensitive information that's classified that's owned by the government. So if you're in a position and you've got access to that type of information and you put, all sorts of information about you, your work, and your contacts out on social media, just be aware that that could draw unwanted attention from foreign adversaries or other hostile actors.
This movie, this film, really targets China. Tell us why and more about that.
Well, I think it's based on a story. It's based loosely on the case of a former CIA officer named Kevin Mallory, who was approached this way. Gradually over time, they recruited him, and he was then convicted of conspiring to provide classified information to China. I will say, though, China is not the only threat actor in this space. We see multiple nation-state threat actors conducting the very similar activity, and criminal actors. But we have seen, and as you'll see from the number of other nations, including the UK, Lithuania, Australia, Germany, have all come out publicly and talked about just how aggressive China is in this space. And so we have seen them being about as aggressive as anyone in conducting these schemes, but this problem is by no means limited only to China.
And do you have any numbers as far as how big a problem this is?
We see thousands of Americans targeted this way. I'll give you one example. In 2017, Germany's domestic intelligence agency conducted a study of this, and they found that more than 10,000 German citizens, including members of parliament, government, and other agencies, were targeted by Chinese intelligence just in a nine-month period.
Who do you want to see this movie, and how and why is it being distributed as it is?
I think we want people in U.S. government who have clearances to see this movie, as they've been targeted through these techniques. We want people in private industry, a whole range of different industries, to see this movie, as they have been targeted. People in academia, and basically the general public. If you have access to information that may be of interest to foreign adversaries, we recommend you watch this movie. We have put the movie, the FBI has put the movie on their YouTube. And it's available for anyone on the web. It details inspired by true events, but it details a fictional account of a former CIA or a former intelligence community official who was targeted by a foreign intelligence services using a fake profile on a professional network site. They approached that person through the fake profile, recruited that individual to eventually turn over classified information.
That was Dean Boyd, Chief Communications Executive at the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers are warning the United States about failing to adapt to a growing Chinese threat. India now has more than 6.2 million total COVID-19 cases, but a new study say the actual number could be about 10 times higher than that. India says three soldiers have been killed by Pakistani fire in Kashmir. China estimates that 13 million railway passenger trips were made on Thursday at the start of the Golden Week holiday, the highest for a single day since the coronavirus outbreak began in February. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Hong Kong riot police patrolled the route of a banned anti-government march on Thursday, preventing crowds from gathering as Chief Executive Carrie Lam cheered the city's return to stability at China National Day celebrations. More from correspondent Libby Hogan.
Holding banners and calling for their loved ones to be released. The relatives of 12 Hong Kong people arrested at sea last month marched to the mainland's representative office in Hong Kong on Wednesday. They left mooncakes, a traditional gift for mid-autumn festival near the barricades, and chanted, "Return our children." The 12, of whom 10 were facing charges related to anti-government protests last year, were arrested on August 23rd for suspected illegal entry into mainland Chinese waters as they attempted to flee by boat to self-ruled Taiwan. They are being held in Shenzhen, and their families say they have been denied access to independent lawyers. The father of detainee Cheng Zi-ho broke down in tears.
I don't even know how my children are. Is this too much to ask for? My son is also a Hong Kong citizen. He pays his taxes.
Hong Kong authorities have said the 12 will be represented by mainland lawyers chosen by the detainees from a list provided by Chinese authorities, and that they have offered, quote, needed and feasible assistance to the families. China's foreign ministry has called the 12 separatists, compounding fears of many in Hong Kong about what they see as China's determination to end any push for greater democracy in the financial hub. Mother of detainee Li Ziyin.
Us Hong Kongers who are supposedly running our own city, we can't do anything. They don't respond to us, not even to our four requests.
In a statement on Tuesday, the liaison office said the facts related to their crimes were clear, and that people with, quote, ulterior motives were, quote, spreading rumors about the 12 to instigate illegal demonstrations.
That was correspondent Libby Hogan. Police had banned the protest, citing coronavirus-related restrictions on group gatherings and violence at previous marches. Shoppers and passers-by still broke into pro-democracy chants sporadically, but there was no sign of a large crowd. Anti-government protests, which often turned violent in 2019, have been smaller and fewer this year due to coronavirus restrictions on group gatherings and fears of arrest under the new security law. Under the new law, anyone in Hong Kong believed to be carrying out terrorism, separatism, subversion of state power, or collusion with foreign forces could be tried and face life in prison if convicted. Happening now in Asia, researchers warn that Asia has become the world's surveillance hotspot and is at risk of serious privacy breaches as measures rolled out to contain the spread of COVID-19 become permanent in many countries. Among the worst-scoring Asian nations in the new report were Pakistan, China, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, India, and the Philippines. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. The first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden resembled more of a shouting match than a structured exchange of ideas. Debate organizers say they're working on changes to ensure a more productive discussion for the candidate's next encounter. But analysts say the chaotic outcome of their first meeting is also a reflection of the country's deep political polarization. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Squera has the story.
Social media exploded with memes during the first presidential debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden, with many viewers characterizing it as childish and as old men yelling at each other.
This is a left-wing problem. This is radical left.
Will you shut up, man?
There were plenty of personal insults.
Yeah, there's nothing smart about you, Joe. 47 years, you've done nothing.
Listen, you're the worst president America has ever had. Come on.
Jennifer Mercia is a professor of political communications at Texas A&M University.
The kinds of things that we saw last night in the debate are exactly the kinds of things that erode democracy, that in fact our democracy is at risk. And you can tell by the way that political leaders talk to one another.
Discussions about the pandemic, economic recovery, and racial unrest were drowned out by insults and interruptions and shocking moments such as when the president refused to denounce white supremacists. Proud Boys, a far-right group that engages in political violence, celebrated the president's remarks and created online memes with his answer. On Wednesday, Trump said he does not know who they are.
Over 200,000 dead, 14 million jobs lost, and Donald Trump spent an entire debate blaming others.
The Biden campaign launched a post-debate digital ad blitz highlighting Trump's remarks. While the Trump campaign claimed that the moderator and the media treated Trump unfairly in the debate and that Biden is weak. Tim Murtaugh is the director of communications for the Trump re-election campaign.
Joe Biden, who was put on his heels most of the time, spent a lot of time looking around for assistance from the moderator and sort of looking around for someone to bail him out.
Initial polls show that the chaotic debate did little to sway voters.
It was very disappointing for American democracy and the country as a whole. It was embarrassing, to be honest with you.
As campaigning enters its final weeks, both campaigns are trying to find voters they can still win over in the key swing states seen as most likely to affect the results. The remaining two presidential debates and one vice presidential debate are scheduled in October. Patsy Whitaker-Squera, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. A U.S. man is facing 2 years behind bars after penning negative online reviews about a Thailand hotel, including accusing the business of modern-day slavery, according to reports. All of the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. At the University of Arizona, students and staff are using an app that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. Michelle Quinn reports on how the app gives health authorities the ability to fine-tune advice to people who have been exposed.
At the University of Arizona, students are encouraged to download COVID Watch, an app developed on campus that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who's tested positive for the coronavirus. The app also helps determine the person's risk of getting infected based on that exposure, providing health officials with important information to help tailor their advice in each case. Joyce Schroeder, a molecular and cellular biology professor, is the campus lead working on the app.
The campus itself has the ability now to set the exposure notification levels. And what does that mean? That means that if we want it to be really, really sensitive and pick up the smallest potential exposures, we can set the app so that it's going to notify somebody with the smallest exposures. We can go all the way in the other direction and set it so that it's only notifying people if they're absolutely, no question, heavily exposed to somebody.
Around the country, officials are turning to apps like these to help in the fight against COVID. They are using the technology to figure out when to notify people who've been exposed and what to tell them to do next, says Jeffrey Kahn, director of Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics.
There's a little bit of laboratory of the states happening. So Arizona may do something. Virginia may do something else. And we will learn. You know, maybe we won't learn everything we need to for this pandemic, but everything we learn in this pandemic will be useful for the next pandemic.
The standard health recommendation now is if you're exposed to the virus, you stay home for 14 days. But Samir Halai, co-founder of COVID Watch, says technology like his app gives health officials the ability to personalize what they tell people to do.
We individualize the quarantine recommendation based on your specific exposure history. What we're also now adding is personalization, where we can look at your specific risk profile, your age, pre-existing conditions, and things like that. Then those are some things we can use to personalize recommendations even further. We need to be more nuanced about what we ask people to do.
The app can work based on a community's specific needs, Halai said. A city with few cases may want to notify and lock down everyone who's been exposed. A city with a major outbreak might not be able to do that and would set the app to notify people most at risk. But the first step, getting people to download the app.
I have, like, I guess, like, privacy questions about it. Like, I wasn't sure how much information am I, like, giving my name? Am I knowing exact people who, you know, oh, that person has had contact, like, stay away from them. I didn't know if, like, that was the energy behind it.
I've, like, read up on it a little bit, and honestly, I feel pretty good about it. I don't know. I know there's, like, they've done a lot of stuff, to avoid privacy issues, so I think it sounds pretty legit.
University officials are in a race against the virus, hoping the app will help them to keep people safe and allow the campus to stay open. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Are my pets safe from coronavirus? There's no current evidence that cats and dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
The global novel coronavirus pandemic has changed the world. As such, it's created a stressful environment compounded by the uncertainty of one's health, economic future, and more. VOA's David Byrd spoke with Claire Nikogosyan via Skype. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical associate professor in the Department of Human Behavior and Clinical Psychiatry at Brown University Medical School in Providence, Rhode Island. David began the conversation by asking Dr. Nkugasian what strategies can be employed to address either helplessness or homelessness.
Hope is something that is this feeling of at some point it's going to get better. But now we're into month six, seven, you know, depending on where you live. And maybe people don't feel that hope. They feel weary and they feel tired and they feel drained and confused and just overwhelmed, burdened. And what I encourage people to do is to consider what we're living through is one, extraordinary, and two, unprecedented. You know, different generations have had different hardships. This is a global hardship. And so understand that many of us are in survival mode and maybe haven't had experiences in our life to draw upon to get through this time. So it feels even more disorienting. And so what I find myself saying a lot is that every person has to take care of themselves. And that involves taking care of your physical health and your body. So, you know, those practical things that we need to access good coping skills. Are we getting enough sleep? Are we hydrating our bodies? Are we feeding ourselves nutritious food? Are we getting out and moving as often as possible in a safe way, you know, given our situations and where we may live? These are the important things that we can manage. We may not be able to manage other things outside of our home or in our communities, but how we take care of ourselves is so important right now. So I always say to people, you know, don't underestimate the importance of being mindful to take care of your physical health, because your physical health impacts your mental health. So the second practical thing that I find myself practicing myself and also encouraging clients is this is the time to set really good boundaries. And, you know, that is part of your emotional self-care.
It feels like there's a lot of pandemic fatigue, like people are just tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, if I get it, I don't care. I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to go do what I could do this time last year.
Mm-hmm.
And now, what do you recommend as far as when those feelings of I'm tired of it, I just want to get away from it, I just want to go be quote unquote normal again, kind of wash over you?
Sure, of course. So one, I would say know yourself. Know what your limits are. And the next question I would, you know, ask this person is, have you gotten enough sleep? Are you hydrated? Have you had a meal today? Are we making decisions based on reactivity or responsiveness? And often when we make decisions out of reactivity, we're not really grounded. And of course, sometimes we have to make quick decisions. But, you know, when you're willing to take a risk and kind of throw your arms up and say the heck with it, right? It's important to kind of do a little inner reflection and say, is this reactivity or responsiveness? Is this something that's really going to be beneficial to me? Because one of the greatest epidemics we have, you know, globally is loneliness. And this was before COVID. I'm very concerned about mental health and loneliness. I'm very concerned, you know, living in Rhode Island and, you know, heading into the fall and the winter months here, very concerned about seasonal affective disorder, depression, substance dependence, domestic violence. You know, things can be overwhelming. And so we have to take care of ourselves and our families, and that's the place we can start. So when you feel that fatigue, and it's important to say to yourself, what's the one thing that's possible that I can do to take care of myself that will give me sustainable impact? You know, so meaning maybe a social event outside with people you trust, you'd reap the benefits for a week or two. Maybe a nice long hike, you'd reap the benefits. Maybe getting on a plane safely and going to see a relative that you haven't seen in, you know, 8 or 9 months. So I think that's the individual piece, is that we want to make decisions from a place of responsiveness, not reactivity.
VOA's David Byrd speaking with Claire Nkugasian, a licensed clinical psychologist and clinical associate professor at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. And you can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our managing director, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.